Pleasure to be at Premier, my first time here. Thank you for remembering the title before I wrote it. So this is work with Simeon Hellerman and Tsutomu Yanagida, both at IPMU. So it's on this paper, which was a couple months ago now, time flies. And there'll be a follow-up work, which it's always dangerous to write a partial archive number, because things might change. But this will hopefully come out in about a week or two. So I'll present some stuff that's in both of them. Okay, so in interest of time, I will kind of cut my introduction short a little bit because I have some new results I want to put in. But just to give a little background about what I want to talk about. So the question here is about charge quantization. Right, so this has been empirically observed for, 100 years or something maybe, whenever we knew about particles, roughly. So alpha particles, beta particles, and it's continued to be measured in various types of experiments. And the limits on neutrality of atoms are extremely strong at this point, something like 1 part in 10 to the 21 or something like that. But anyway, theoretically, which is more of my concern here, we have a Dirac monopole or string. Right, so we all learn about this in quantum mechanics, for instance, or E&M. And this kind of gets generalized into field theories, where you have monopole solutions also, generically in non-abelian gauge theories. And finally, moving further up the food chain, so to speak, we have grand unified theories, which you see charge quantization as basically of extremely, I would say, model-independent result of guts. It comes from the idea of putting together gauge groups of the standard model together in one unified gauge group. And so there are the relations due to for instance, an SU5 or SO10 model, the generators there and their interactions give you quantized charge once you break down to the standard model. Anyway, I'm not going to go into any more details, but this is kind of the basic understanding of how charge has been quantized. And I think now most particle physicists, we don't really think about it. And if we did, we'd just say, oh, yeah, things go into a gut eventually, and that's where charge quantization comes from. You know? Yeah, so if you take that's right. That's some other work done by Volker and others in Australia or New Zealand. If you look at anomaly constraints in the standard model, you do get some conditions, but you have to use the Yukawa terms also. So it's not just purely the gauge anomalies. It's also to be able to write down Yukawa terms, so assuming the structure of the standard model roughly. And so that gives you, I would say, a consistency more than anything. There's some questions there about how you treat neutrinos, I believe. If you want to write down neutrino mass or something, that changes your conditions.
The thing I have in mind is not that it doesn't run through. I was assisting the other day. This is the anomaly quantization of the standard model is a statement with sums of various charges, and charges given to zero.
Right.
But then that in itself, as I understand it, doesn't force the charges to be quantized. But if you add to it the Lorentz U1 anomaly, which people often didn't do in particle physics because it's Lorentz is gravity as a model. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not completely familiar with that. What I am familiar roughly with the anomalies and stuff there is not the strongest argument. I kind of view that as more of a consistency type relation because you really have to assume the structure of the standard model in order to do it, of the matter representations of the gauge groups. And so I don't know if I take that as a... Yeah, I would say grand unified theory is purely from the structure of grand unified theory. The fact that you have gauge groups that are unified into a single gauge group.
So it's the standard model plus extra baggage, right? Or is this the standard model plus the Lorentz invariant to give you the anomaly?
Yeah, so I'm not entirely familiar with that, but maybe you can show me the result later. Yeah, but it sounds related to the stuff that what people do, the anomalies plus there. I think they need the Yukawa terms, but for constraints. But anyway, so yeah. You can just think of it as you have the gauge fields for SU5, for instance. And so there's a relation between the commutators for them. And so when you eventually, so there's a quantization there. And so the fact that you get your U1 and standard model out of that means the charges there are quantized, yeah. So the question is, can we do this? Can we quantize charge without a monopole, without a gut, or without any other constraints? And the answer is yes. There's also phenomenological issues here, which I'm sure are familiar with everyone, so I'll skip it in the interest of time. But the answer I'm going to show is yes, using kind of very familiar physics in nonlinear sigma models. So briefly, just an outline of what I'll talk, so you know where I'm going. So I'll give you the summary first of the basic idea and the result. And then I'll give you the derivation, which I will skip a lot of the details of in order to present some further results. Before that, there'll be some preliminaries on CP1 and nonlinear sigma models as necessary, but I assume most of this is familiar except for maybe CP1. Anyway, from this then, I'll go on to a little bit of CP1 pheno. Some new results in CP2, which here the interesting, very interesting result is getting the standard model generation structure. So in other words, seeing the matter content of what's in a standard model generation comes from the CP2 structure. So with some additional assumptions on, mild assumptions, I would say, on how you get there. But I'll talk about that. So that's a new result in the paper to come out shortly. And then I'll probably be completely out of time, so you know, I'll talk maybe a little bit about where else it's going and some other phenomenological issues. But that's the idea here. Okay, so let me give you the claim. So we have charge quantization, I'll just call it CQ, in the CP1 nonlinear sigma model. Without a monopole or a gut structure. Okay, so you have none of the phenomenological issues of heavy monopoles or of proton decay and other issues there. So interesting phenomenology here, I already kind of mentioned for CP2. For CP1, the Nambel-Goldstone boson is fractionally charged. And so there's some potentially interesting phenomenology there with what you can do with it. But anyway, so all of this comes out, the charge quantization, all of it comes out from the structure of the nonlinear sigma model. Okay, so the structure of it, the dynamics, the constraints on writing down the sigma model. Okay, so let me get right to it. For nonlinear sigma models, there's not really much I need, right? So the language I'll be using here is really the nonlinear part of this. So I'm going to define this as a nonlinearly realized symmetry, which I'll call G. Okay? And then there's a linearly realized subgroup, that R just jumped right over, which I'll call H. Okay, and for now, I'm going to talk about this kind of generally. So the groups I'll be talking about here for CP1, for instance, will be SU2 and U1, but those are not the standard model groups. I'll talk about how that works later. So we can kind of think of this as the coset model G mod H. Of course, there's a lot of other things you can do with this besides the obvious relation to symmetry breaking in particle physics. There's also mathematical kind of results with thinking of coset spaces and such. Anyway, for CP1, there's several different ways to think about CP1, of which some might be more familiar. In general, you can think of it as, or any CP space as, in this case, will be two complex coordinates. Which I will call Z1 and Z2. Which have an identification under a scaling lambda. Okay, geometrically, you can think of this as complex lines in C2 passing through the origin. Sorry, in the paper, I think we call this phi, but I'll keep with z's for now. I can write this in terms of two affine coordinates, which is what I'll use here, which I'll call z plus and z minus, which is, you know, the ratio of z1 to z2, or vice versa. Okay, so that's one way of thinking of it, kind of standard complex type geometry. If you want to think of it as a manifold, it's S2. right? So this kind of gives you the two-dimensional sphere. So this gives you an idea of maybe of where the derivation is going to come from. In the modern understanding of the monopole due to Wu and Yang, you write this as thinking of a gauge field, which gives you, or a gauge configuration, which gives you a monopole, a magnetic monopole. In that case, then, to write down consistently the field over all space, you're led to a quantization condition between magnetic and electric charge. Right, so this is kind of the modern way we think of it, the way probably most of us have learned it. And so that's going to be directly analogous, in a sense, to the fact that CP1 is S2 as a manifold. So the important part here is that it has two coordinate patches. In other words, you can't cover the sphere in one set of coordinates. Several different ways of seeing that, but I'll leave that as is. As groups, so this is maybe more familiar in the particle physics sense. It's SU2 broken down to U1. Okay, so G and H here are my non-linearly realized and linearly realized groups. Yes, that's right. And you can see, you can make the relation between this and this by considering general matrix structure for SU2 and acting with U1 on it, and you get this identification. So there's completely analogous these different ways of thinking about it. Okay, so the basic idea of how I'm going to do charge quantization is related to this fact of thinking of CP1 as a manifold. So I want to have a complex charged field. Matter field, chi. And I want to write down explicitly its transformations under SU2 and U1. Okay, so I want to have SU2 is non-linearly realized, while the U1, of course, is still good. Okay, and I want to do this over the entire CP1 group manifold. In order to do that, that will require considering both the coordinate patches and matching between them to have it well-defined over entire CP1. And that's what's going to give me charge quantization in this model. So that's the basic idea of what I want to do here. I will kind of leave out some of the details of the derivation, although it appears in the paper also. But let me give you some of the flavor of it. Is there any questions on the basic setup, what I mean here? Not yet, not yet. So what I want to do in the end, though, is I want to have this U1 be U1 hypercharge, so that my quantization of U1 charge in the sigma model becomes quantization of hypercharge in the standard model. Right. So I'll discuss that.
Is this similar to the Jordan Bach?
Yeah, so here, the point is here, I'm taking SU2 as a non-linearly realized group. So I'm never working in a linear sigma model and breaking it, for instance. Right? So this is always a non-gauged, non-linearly realized group. So there's no gauge bosons there. There's no of that structure. Right? So this is different from thinking of an SU2 unified model or something, or you know, embedding.
Isn't this a lower geometric? If I took the Georgi Glasgow model, I took the physical Higgs and aimed out its mass very large, and I went below that mass and below the effective theory here, and I'd be very
linear. Yeah, the effective theory should match this, but in this case, I'm not taking. I can take the scale where this associated with this nonlinear realization. I can take it arbitrarily high in this case. There's nothing associated with it. I don't know if that answers. Well, there's no gauge bosons for SU2. I'm never gauging it, which is perhaps distinct from. I mean, for now, without thinking about the standard model and the fact that I have gauge symmetries, for now, think of this as a global effective SU2 broken to a U1. I will eventually gauge the U1, which explicitly breaks the SU2. That's right. Yeah, so I'll talk about that at the end, after the derivation, I guess. But you can always think of that I'm working in the limit as I take gauge couplings and all other couplings to zero, in where this is an effective symmetry, SU2 broken to U1, as global symmetries. Yeah, but that's a good question. For some of the details here, roughly what I want to do is, first I want to think of whatever, Z plus and Z minus. In the particle physics sense, these are my gauge, my Nambu-Goldstone bosons of this nonlinear sigma model. Okay, so I first want to think about Z plus, where V is just some scale here for units, but you could think of this as the scale of where this effective theory is good up to. And nothing will depend on this V, so I can take this arbitrarily high in some sense. And the ratio of the, of my two coordinates. Okay, very briefly, if I think of my SU2 G generators as T plus, T minus, and T0, where T0 is my unbroken U1, I can write the action on Z plus Okay, so this plus is the charge here. So I've kind of normalized everything so that this the charge, the Nambu-Goldstone boson, is plus one, okay, based on how the T0 generator acts on it. And here you can see explicitly that's a nonlinear realized symmetry because of the fact that this transformation depends on Z plus squared. I can write this then for any function of Z plus by just tacking on a derivative at the end for all of these. Okay, so I can have any function of Z plus. Right, so I'm working in two patches, as I mentioned. So in one patch, I'll deal with coordinate Z plus. In the other one, I'll have Z minus. So this one we called, I think, the southern hemisphere, although I guess it's arbitrary. But where one of these equals 0 is the different poles. I want to say this is what we call the south pole. Okay, so in other words, in one patch, we have where Z plus is never 0, and the other patch where Z minus is never 0. Okay, so in other words, the patches, if we think of this as a sphere, right, I can define coordinates on the entire sphere except for at one point. Right, so if I think about one of these being my south pole and one of these being my north pole, I can cover all the way up to one pole, but not both of them. Right, so for simplicity, you can just think of the bottom sphere and the top sphere as my two coordinate patches. And then consistency across where they match as a way of joining up my coordinates. Sorry, to go back to here, I have my usual algebra. For SU2. Okay, so again, this is purely in terms of the Goldstones. I haven't considered matter at all here. But you've noticed, perhaps, that I'm only talking so far about Z plus and not Z plus bar. Right? So I could label these all as the holomorphic pieces, and then I'd write down the anti-holomorphic pieces, but I won't write them down explicitly, but we can use this rule where I switch T0's sign and T plus and T minus. The minus sign. Okay, so this gives me my anti-holomorphic generator. So everything I'm gonna write down in terms of holomorphic generators of Z plus, and then I can get the anti-holomorphic generators by doing these sign changes. And then on any function of Z plus and Z plus bar, I just combine the holomorphic and the anti-holomorphic generators. Right, so if I just want some arbitrary function of Z plus and Z plus bar. Okay, I won't need to do that explicitly, so I won't, but that's how it works. For Z minus, while I'm writing these, the important thing here is just that if I think about the T minus generator acting this, this works with a minus Z minus. Okay, so hence the name Z plus and Z minus. Okay. Is this one? Oh, I guess I can just. Yeah. Okay, so I have some things to say also about another way of seeing this besides these explicit coordinates, but let me just continue in this path first, and then I'll come back to talking about that. Okay, so like I said, I'll work in the southern hemisphere first. And this is where z minus is never zero. So maybe, yeah, z minus is the north pole then. Yeah, cool. All right, so let me now consider my charge scalar field. Okay, here, there's nothing I can really say yet about how it transforms other than the fact that I know it's a linear representation of the U1. So I'll write it like this. Sorry. This is on functions of chi. All right, so I'll put explicitly the d chi. While for t plus t minus as some arbitrary functions, this is the same chi. OK, so in other words, here I'm working in the coordinates z plus and with field chi. When I go to the northern hemisphere, I have to change that. Okay, but so far, this is undetermined, right? Just some arbitrary function right now, while alpha is its charge. Right, so the idea is I want to see at the end that I have some condition on alpha. Okay, but as of now, it's just some complex number. And again, still working just on holomorphic functions, anti-holomorphic functions, go through that rule, and then you can combine them. Okay, and so now, to save myself some writing, the full generators here, of course, is this, you know, the delta t0 acting on the chi piece plus delta t0 acting on the z plus piece, the combination of the two boards. Okay, again, this is the holomorphic. And I can add up the anti-holomorphic. So now I could have, up to these functions, the action of the SU2 group on functions of chi and z plus and their complex conjugates. OK, so now there's several constraints even before I move to the northern hemisphere. So first is considering the SU2 algebra. This gives me a set of equations with for f plus and f minus. OK, so I construct using now the full Nambu-Goldstone plus chi pieces over here and over here. And in order to get the SU2 algebra, I get some differential equations on f plus and f minus. So I can solve these, and I can get a form for f plus and f minus, which I'll write down briefly. Right, so you just have some linear first order partial differential equations. They're not difficult. Even mathematically, you can solve them. And this quantity here is just a dimensionless quantity where everything has units as you'd expect. This is an alpha minus 1. OK, so alpha is the charge of chi. And this f plus is now just some arbitrary function of this quantity. And similar for f minus.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you make it non-linear transformation on the Goldstone? Like, you just write it down and it works, but
you can derive this by thinking of the usual SU2 action on the homogeneous coordinates, which I've lost, and then using that to generate the how they act on these coordinates, right? This is just a function of the homogeneous coordinates.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can do the usual way. The only thing to be careful of is that you have to get the signs right in that the usual way of a transformation acting on something versus acting on a function of something, there's this minus sign in this case. But yeah. Yeah, but this follows. This is, you can just write down.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly the type of construction we're following here, basically. Okay, so one further restriction. Let me keep this. One further restriction here is I'm going to work to linear order in chi, and that's through the kind of the usual restrictions in that I can just expand in powers of chi and close everything off order by order. So the typical kind of way that we work with kind of a symmetry analysis, a local analysis. Okay, so let me just write that here so don't forget. Okay, so from now on everything I'll just expand in powers of chi, so I have a function of this unitless thing which involves chi, so I can expand that order to order and should close order by order in chi. Okay, along with some, I can also absorb any constants into a shift here. Okay, so far I've gotten somewhere, right? I've gotten some functions of f plus and f minus, but now I want it to be smooth at the south pole is my first place. So this is where z plus equals 0, and this gives me that f minus is 0, while f plus is some constant times z plus chi. Okay, and using, I didn't say this here, but just two of the commutators give me enough to get these two differential equations. So I have one more commutator left, and that fixes this constant here as minus 2 alpha over v. Okay, so now I can write down my holomorphic and anti-holomorphic generators for functions of z plus and chi. Everything's completely specified now, but only in one coordinate patch. Okay, and I haven't gotten any restrictions on alpha, but I was able to specify those nonlinear functions f plus and f minus to begin with. So I got that. Okay, in the interest of time, I'll make this very short. It's pretty straightforward, so now I want to switch to the coordinate z minus, which we're going to write it now as a function of z plus. I also have to change chi, right? Chi also transforms as I go to a different place in CP1. So I also will have some transformation here, which is arbitrary, and I'll work to linear order still in chi. Okay, so this also is some function now unspecified, which I will need to determine. But I have my coordinate change here, so now I can just kind of plow through the usual way of changing coordinates and transfer from my z plus and chi to my z minus and chi prime variables. Right, so I can do all of that, and I will not write any of it. There's one more thing I need to know, though, before I can look at what the constraints are here. And that is, I have to think about how this U1 is related in the different patches, right? The unbroken U1. Right? In general, it's just going to be a U1, but it might change. So here I can realize if I think of my sphere again, and I think of two points, any antipodal points, but in this case the poles, right? They're fixed by the same U1 generator. Okay, so in other words, the eigenvalue of chi and chi prime both have well-defined eigenvalues on the same U1H. Okay, I didn't say what the eigenvalues are, but they're eigenvalues under the same U1, so I can talk about the relation. Okay. So now I have everything I need in order to compare what the transformations are on the northern hemisphere. I should say that here. So let me write that down very quickly. So once I put it all together and transform everything, remember alpha is my charge of the field. So now everything's here in terms of z minus. So on any function, that's why I put these derivatives here. Sorry, I should have specified what this gives us here. This gives me that f of z plus or z minus, since I know how they relate, is a pure power. Okay, for how, didn't erase them, how delta T0 acts. And so this gives me that it's a pure power, which I can write as z minus to the minus v with some powers of v to make that work by units. OK, so now I have these constraints. So now I have to enforce that it's non-singular everywhere. So at the North Pole, right, where z minus equals 0, right, this gives me that this piece can't be here. So I have p equals minus 2 alpha. So p is this power of the coordinate of the field transformation chi and chi prime. Alpha is the field's charge. And also that chi and chi prime should be single valued everywhere. So this transformation, which uses power p, should be an integer. Okay, so all of this together implies that p is an element of the integers. And so I have that alpha is in the half integers. OK, so this is my charge quantization condition. Right? So alpha is the charge relative to the Nambu-Goldstone. Right? That's what I kind of normalized to 1. So any matter field here has charge of some half integer multiple of the Goldstone charge, OK, purely from the structure of CP1. Okay, of how the fields transform and just define them well everywhere. So I said I want to say something about kinetic terms. Also, I didn't say anything about supersymmetry, but I do want to say something about supersymmetry. So if you look back at, like up here, for instance, just talking about the Goldstone, right, everything there kind of has a nice supersymmetrization. Right, and n equals 1 supersymmetry. Right, everything's a function of holomorphic z plus. The kinetic terms can be written term as the Kähler usual Fubini-Stunde metric on CP1, gives me just the Kähler potential for z plus and z minus. So everything there is a nice, easily supersymmetric model. Once I add matter, that's not necessarily true, right? There's no reason why chi has to have kinetic terms from some Kähler metric, from some Kähler structure, which is stable under renormalization. But so for simplicity, what I've assumed this whole time is that it's n equals 1 supersymmetric. You notice I've never used a supersymmetry transformation. I never say anything about supersymmetry in the derivation. So I don't need it, but it gives me that if I were instead thinking of the kinetic terms here, so thinking about a Kähler potential which gives me kinetic terms for chi, I get exactly this structure out by having it be well-defined everyone CP1 and have the right transformation properties under SU2 and U1. It would give me exactly the same thing. So there, it's a little bit more clear maybe that I want that structure to be stable under any type of renormalization effects. So there, supersymmetry guarantees me that. But it's not clear that I need supersymmetry to say that I have that structure. And that's something that we'll work on in a follow-up and kind of specifying more how to have any corrections under control. Okay, but the basic structure, though, is through the nonlinear sigma model with supersymmetry.
So does this have more content?
I mean, yeah, but does that tell you that the entries are integers, for instance, or integer?
You always have the freedom of scaling out the gauge problem, right? So the absolute, you're never going to get this absolute, and you're kind of normalizing the charge of this
goal. Yeah.
So if I think of I get to choose one, and I'll be one.
Yeah, but the question is, the trace doesn't tell you that you can't have something that's like pi times 1 charge? Or, I mean, does that tell you about the representations of it, I guess, is what I'm asking. If there's...
Yeah, I could have had a bunch of integers and pi minus pi.
Yeah, for instance. Yeah, I'm not sure there's any... As far as I know, there's no way to see charge quantization without the structures we talked about earlier, guts or monopoles or possibly anomaly constraints.
If you have natural light,
But
that's specific to the standard model fermion matter content, right? You added the chiral fermions, if you added a vector like a new vector like fermion,
right,
it wouldn't be constrained at all by that.
But you're never going to be able to prove that all possible things are always quantize, right? You can't do that either. But he's just saying in this particular theory, there's some quantization relationship. And so we're interested in it for the one that we know of nature. So.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, let me think about the more. Let me continue. Maybe that'll. SU11? That I don't know, because that's not compact. So that's the question, is if it's purely the fact that SU2 mod U1, the U1 has a compact origin. And that's also something where if you actually write down all this stuff for SU, at least, so I don't know if it makes sense to write down the same stuff in SU11 the way I wrote down. But in terms of everything I wrote down, except for some signs that change, it's exactly the same. But I don't know if that analysis makes sense in SU11 because it's non-compact and the way the coordinates work there. So
same kind of thing. If I add new sectors to the theory that don't couple to this chart, then you're not
right. But I think the point is that you can take the standard model you want and just complete it into this sector and say then it's guaranteed that under that you want all ratios and charges all charges should be integer multiples of the p associated with that you want.
Yeah. So that's exactly what I want to do. Is I want to take this you want to be the hypercharge you want in order to explain standard model charge quantization. And that gets me into a little bit of the phenomenology here, which I will do very quickly, and then I can come back to if there's time. But right, so what I want to do is I want to see that I can make this to be the hypercharge. Okay, so first of all, there's some number here, right? How I decide to do that. So there's some overall scaling here. Just phenomenologically, if I think about this, I want that, you know, in order to fix this, I'm going to take it to be 1/2 so that my smallest hypercharged is 1/6 like quarks in the standard model. Yes, in other words, here, this was half integers, right? So any charge, in this case, Q, is n over 2 for some integer times 1, the Goldstone charge. So here I have, I want this to be a third, excuse me, so that all my hypercharges are multiples of a 6. OK, so then I can fit all the hypercharges in here easily. There's no constraints here. That will be more complicated in the other models I'll talk about. Okay, but a little bit of pheno, but I want to really go on to the CP2 stuff. But here, this tells you that the Nambu-Goldstone boson has hypercharge, right, 1/3. Okay, so it's some fractionally charged particle. I gauge the U1, right? So this breaks, this breaks explicitly the SU2. Right, but like I said, in the limit, this is controlled by the gauge coupling. So if I smoothly take this to 0, I get back to the pure global model I have here. And so charge quantization as a property doesn't change under this type of explicit breaking. And this also then means that the Nambu-Goldstone boson gets a mass, right? Which goes like square root of alpha hypercharge times scale here. So if I'm talking about the fact that this was supersymmetric, then this is protected down to the Suzy breaking scale, for instance. Otherwise, this is just m of the nonlinear sigma model, whatever scale it's valid up to. So phenomenologically, you could play with this and have it be light, have it be very heavy. There's, of course, if it's light, there's severe constraints on dark matter or any type of charged particle in the early universe. If it's very heavy, you can escape, I think, most of those. By very heavy, I mean like 10 to the 15, 10 to the 17 GeV, right? Extremely absurdly heavy. If it's light enough, you can make it in a collider. It'd be kind of a exotic type thing because of the fractional charge. You could use it for nuclear physics, fractionally charged, a heavy fractionally charged particle, which is completely stable here, right? There's nothing it can decay to. So it's completely stable, which is what can give you some problems cosmologically depending on its mass range. Anyway, so there's some model building and pheno you can do with it. But I want to skip to the CP2 model. Right, so you say, well, this is good, but can you generalize it? The answer is yes. If I think now about CP2, Right here I have a Z1, Z2 are my two gold stones. Okay, and I have SU3 broken to SU2 across U1. Okay, and things are a little bit more complicated. I can do this directly. I can do exactly the same analysis I did, but it's more complicated because I think I have three patches here I need to consider. Obviously, I have more gold stones, so everything's a bit more complicated. You can do it directly. But there's an easier way to do it. So instead, I can think about how to get CP1 out of CP2. Right? But let me first just say how I want to characterize my matter here. Chi will have charge Q chi. And I'm going to characterize it by its tuality, or duality, which I don't think anyone uses. But this tuality, you can just think of, let me call this D, as minus 1 to the d equals its eigenvalue under the center of the group. So center of, sorry, of SU2, which is just minus 1 is the generator for that.
Before you go much further into this, if you could, let me ask another stupid question. So supposing I was thinking of the grand unified theories or something, and I'm thinking that I've got some gauge group somewhere in there is a standard model, so I've got somewhere in SU2 breaking DV1, SU2 plus DV1 breaking DV1. If I, and the charge thing is, the charge quantization issue is going to be something where I'll always have freedom to dial the gauge coupling. So supposing I dial the gauge coupling to zero, so now I want a gauge theory, I've got a global group, whatever the grand unified group was, including an SU2 which is breaking DV1. Why isn't that the same as your, your SU2, I just think of it as being
Yeah, but there's no gauge fields here for the SU2. So there's no interaction associated with the SU2. But you're saying you still want the SU2 to be embedded as part of the gut group.
Yeah, because that's all you're really using. Right? You're saying that the hypercharge is sitting inside an SU2, which you break, and then your Boltzmann bosons are what you're using to get your topology out of.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean that's. But you're saying you want that global SU2 to be part of SU5, SO10, or you know some gut group.
Yeah, the distinction between global and gauge seems like it's not really important for your argument, in the sense that because you've always had this freedom to dial the charges are always you can scale the gauge couplings into the charges for free anyway, so that you always have this freedom to scale the gauge couplings. So you just take the gauge coupling right to zero, and then you're in the global.
Yeah, I'm saying if you take, you know, think of like you know, pions, our usual example of nonlinearly realized symmetries and symmetry breaking in a standard model. Like here, I'm saying that the U1 comes from some effective, looks like it comes, you know, okay, let's say we observe some particle discharge. Then all of that together says it looks like it comes from some effective nonlinearly realized SU2 global symmetry, where there's no, you know, there's nothing here which, I don't know, kind of, I mean, saying think of the U1 hypercharges coming from this nonlinearly realized SU2. There's, if you want to put the SU2 as part of something else, I'm not sure then what you want to do exactly. But yeah, I mean, it's right. Cause I'm not taking this from some theory where I have. All right, here's an example. If I want to have the linear sigma model and do that, right? Then all the matter I had out of there had to come in some complete multiplets of the linearly realized symmetry that was broken, right? I can't put an incomplete multiplet in some linear sigma model, right? I can't write down a partial set of fields, right? Well, here I can, because all it has to be is just some linear representation under the unbroken group.
Well, I don't disagree with that first line, because that's the essence of the, that's what the nonlinear is. So if you're linearly realizing things, you're saying you have to have a field content for a linear multiplet. But once you've broken the symmetry, then you split the masses of the guys and multiples, and then you can just integrate out some of them.
Well, but split, yeah, but that's not easy, right? I mean, SU5, that's the problem. No, but I mean, that's not easy in the gut, that's a big problem, right? The doublet triplet splitting problem is exactly a problem, splitting the masses of a complete multiplet.
If you could never do it, then that would be a different world. But we know we can do that. But once you've done that, it's for free. You can integrate the heavy guys. And what's left won't have the part of the content to do that. And that's why it's not in the heavy guys.
Yes, so you're wondering if there's any theoretical difference between that limit of taking some set of a matter multiplet as an arbitrarily high mass.
Yeah, because another argument you could have said that someone says it's an SU5 gut, someone says it's an SU10 gut, there's differences in detail, but essentially it's the same argument. And so I'm just thinking, is this just kind of one more variation of that same argument?
Yeah, I'd have to think about that more, I guess. I mean, our point kind of here is that you don't need to put everything together into a gut, right? We don't need any of that extra stuff. I mean, if you want to break a gut and do all that stuff to it, then you're not really, I mean, are you really still getting the gut structure out of it? I mean, if you just want charge quantization, then maybe that's fine. But if you're doing gut model building, you care about, you know, gauge coupling unification, about proton decay, double triplet splitting, all the phenomenology of it, right? If you just want to get charge quantization out of it.
The essence of it is you're sticking the U1 inside a simple group, not a simple group, right? It's not
yeah.
Yeah,
I would say it's in, you know, in flavor it's kind of similar to that, just like the derivation I gave is in flavor similar to the monopole derivation, you know, and kind of similar type of thing, but I still think it seems distinct from whether or not you could construct some sort of gut type thing, which is just this in the end, which you've then thrown out all the rest of the gut structure. I don't doubt you could probably do that as some effective field theory, but yeah, I'm not sure what that buys you exactly. Yeah, I mean,
say I take the sort of, I mean, this is a very stupid gut because it doesn't do all the other things you mentioned, but the gut where you have just SU2 cross SU3, and then the U1 is embedded inside of a gauged SU2.
Mm-hmm.
And that gauged SU2 is broken down to the U1 at some high scale. How is the weak gauge coupling limit of that? Is there some limit of that that's really the same physics? So that would also give you monopoles without tying it.
Yes, so you're saying if you.
Is what you're doing equivalent somehow to that, you know, non-abelian completion of just the standard model you want?
So you want to know what the difference is if you.
Yeah.
So here you have this
I mean, you're wondering if you can just connect. A gauge, basically the question is what's the difference between a gauge and a global symmetry if you take the gauge coupling to zero? I mean, that's...
Like somehow, you're essentially making the U1 compact, and then you could have ordinary direct monopole quantization.
Yeah.
It seems you can do it in a different way. You embed it in an SU2, you fully gauge it, that's what you say, and then you have ordinary monopole. Or as you say, you have this global symmetry and you gauge part of it, and I guess the difference is that in one case, you have a physical pseudo-Boltzmann boson in another case.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that's basically, think of it that way in the lower energy theory, what kind of are the effects? Here too though, of course, I mean this nothing dependent on the scale, M of the thing, so I could take it to be arbitrarily high, and then the low energy is nothing but regular particles with quantized charge. But you would never know that's true. Right? And maybe that's related to these questions of embedding some gut, or you take certain particles arbitrarily high, like, you know, if you've decoupled all the other degrees of freedom except your matter field in low energy theory, how do you tell things apart? I think effectively you can't, but it might be more of a question of if you could probe up to, you know, arbitrarily high scales, then you'd see different structure. So maybe that's related to these questions of, you know, can you just always decouple lots of stuff and get the same kind of thing, which is, I guess, you know, kind of the essence of effective field theory, right, that you have this universality of an effective field theory, you know, at the end. But so maybe that's related to these types of questions.
So the second related question, you mentioned that, I mean, the U1, gauging the U1, as you said, really, really breaks the SU2 gene, right? Not
yeah.
Just non-linearly.
Explicitly breaks it.
Explicit breaking.
Yeah.
So what's the argument that doesn't spoil the charge quantization?
I'm saying that, I mean, this kind of related to your previous question, but as I take, you know, the gauge coupling to zero,
yeah.
That is exactly the model I wrote down, right? There's no explicit breaking of SU2.
How do you know that the charges can't have corrections that are ordered
B? Well, I think that's the same argument as why charge isn't relation between charges isn't renormalized. I think that's basically the same question. You can think, the easiest way I think to see that is you cast the renormalization of the gauge coupling there into the propagator of the photon instead of in the gauge coupling.
I guess you could argue also that the quantization of charge is somehow topological,
right?
Because it's related to these patches that we have. And
right.
You're explicitly ranked for that symmetry, so I don't know why you're allowed to use topological.
Yeah, but the gauging doesn't change the topology of the CP1. Yeah, I think, that's so one of the questions we want to follow up on is, besides gauging, what is the effect of explicit breaking on this type of setup? Or how does explicit breaking break global symmetries and so on, right? So if you think about this as a topological effect of the fact that U1 comes from a compact CP1 group, what kind of damage can I do to the topology and either keep or ruin the charge quantization?
Yeah,
right?
If coupling went to zero, if it maybe just moves.
Right. I mean, that's kind of also asking the question of, like, think of this as an effective field theory. As I take the gauge coupling as zero, I'm saying it's a good effective theory. If I add other explicit breaking or something, then I'm violating that assumption, right? I'm saying it's not a good effective symmetry, right? So these are related questions which we want to kind of quantify a little bit if we can. But for now, that's the limit we're taking it in. I got sidetracked. Let me mention this very quickly because it's interesting, I think. This equals minus 1 to 2j, where j is the usual isospin of the particle under SU2h. Right, so this is just how I'm classifying representations here for CP2. Right, some of these questions, too, might look different in the CP2 case, because CP1 is very simple. Okay, so here what I want to do now is I want to flow to the CP1 model. So I want to add a mass, for z1, let's say, or something, in such a way that I have with some SU2 G prime, I'll call it, invariant, right? So I want to preserve an SU2 G group here. These are not the same, right? So I have several things. So in other words, I want to go to the CP1 model. With SU2 G prime modded out by U1 H prime. Okay, so neither SU2 nor U1 is the same as this SU2 or this U1, right? There's going to be some relation, which I'll need, but right now it's not, right? So all I'm doing is adding a mass and integrating out and flowing to the CP1 model. Okay, so that means that now chi is coupled in a SU2 G prime invariant way, right? Just because this mass term preserves this SU2 G prime. Okay, but I know now that I know that I have quantization in the CP1 case, right? So I know what the quantization is for the U1 H prime, okay, in the CP1 model, embedded in the CP2 model. But that doesn't tell me right away what the charge quantization is in the original model, right? So I know that I have Q, I'll call it H prime, equals n over 2. N is an integer, okay, from the CP1. Okay, so the eigenvalue of some of the matter field under the U1 H prime. So I want to relate this now to this. And so the way I can relate is by going back to here, I can think of the center C being generated by an element some non-central element of the group, like this, okay, where this generator has eigenvalues plus minus a half. Okay, so if I put this in here, I get the generator for the center of SU2. Okay, where this is just some non-central element. Maybe I should call it NCH2. Okay, so this will give me some relation now between how I classify matter as its representation or SU2 in terms of some non-central element of SU2, SU2H here. Okay, so I have three things I want to relate here now, right? I have QH prime. I have QH1, which is the original U1H generator. And I have QCNH2, I called it, the non-central element of H2, of SU2. OK, and so there's some linear relationship between these three because these are three commuting generators of my original SU3. OK, so there must be some, which has rank 2. So there must be some linear relationship between these generators. OK, sorry I'm going fast to this, but it is getting late. Anyway, so I get, if I just write these out as explicit matrices, right, so this is something like plus a half, minus a half, 0. You know, this has similar stuff there. Right, this had a third, minus 2/3, et cetera. Right, so I can just find the relationship between them as matrices, as generators. And this gives me this. OK, so now I use the fact that I know this quantization, right, from the CP1 model. This is the one I want. And this characterizes my representations under the SU2. The original SU2 here. Okay, so if I put it all together, I'll just write it up here. I can write this then as the charge of some field chi. And this two Q is the duality I called it, D over there. Plus 1/3. Okay, so in other words, I can write this as 2n over 3 for a vector or tensor representation. What did I call it? H. And 2n plus 1 over 3 for a spinner. OK, so I've written my charge quantization now for some field as 2n over 3 for a vector or tensor, or 2n plus 1 over 3 for a spinner. So in other words, its charge depends on what representation is under the unbroken SU2. OK, so this is several things I can do. This one, I can just generalize this, right? This becomes my general formula, kn plus t mod k. This is the n-ality for CPK. Okay, where this T is the n-ality of the representation under the unbroken non-abelian part of CPK. Sorry, very quick. But the key point I wanted to get at here, or several key points, one is that this tells you that, you know, something that is transforms under SU2, so if I think about this as SU2 weak, any of my, you know, quark doublets and stuff, can have non-zero charge. Right, n is an integer. So 2n plus 1 over 3 means that I can never have a zero charge for anything which transforms as a spinner under SU2. Okay, while here, of course, I can have zero charge. An interesting application of this, which I won't write because I'm going over time, if I then make the following assumptions, right, that I have a quark doublet. I want no vector-like matter, right? So in other words, I want matter to be light, not just given some vector mass arbitrarily high. And I want anomaly freedom in the standard model. Right? All of this leads to the standard model generation content. Again, I'm not writing the details here, but for instance, I have a quark doublet, and I think about the SU3 cubed anomaly. In order for that to be anomaly free and to have no vector-like matter, I need to add two SU2 singlets, right, up and down. Then I think of the SU3 squared U1 anomaly. Between all those three things, I have some condition on the charges there. Now I go on to the SU2 anomaly with U1. That gives me that I need something to cancel out this doublet contribution, so I have a lepton doublet. Then I go to the gravity squared U1 anomaly. That gives me that I need some right-hand thing to take care of the charge from that lepton doublet. And then finally, the U1 cubed anomaly gives me some relation between all the charges. So what I'm left with is through this, looking at the anomalies, I get the content of the standard model generation, along with some relation between their charges, which is consistent with the standard model charges we have. Sorry if that was a little quick, if it didn't make sense. But the key point here is that, generally speaking, anything which is a non-singlet under this non-abelian part of CPK, unbroken part, CPK, can't have zero charge, right? Which is this, I think, is a very non-trivial observation of how charge quantization works in these models. There's no reason, I think, you'd suspect that you'd get such a relation between charges in this type of setup, right? You have saying you have a non-zero transformation under some unbroken group, and that gives you that you have a non-zero charge, right? So some relation between quantum numbers, which is, I think, unexpected probably in such a thing. Maybe thinking of the structure of CP, you know, CPK of how these two are together and embedded in this, you can see why it's not completely crazy, but it just kind of comes out from this procedure. And so that gives you this kind of really interesting, you know, maybe not pure derivation, but some pretty mild assumptions, which I think we'd say if we want to build a theory with light matter that's anomaly-free with some gauge symmetries, these are my assumptions. And that kind of gives me the standard model generation content as kind of the minimal type solution. I should have said I want minimal representations too. Right, so if I try to build the smallest thing which satisfies these constraints, I get the standard model generation. This is kind of a reverse way of looking at the fact that when you think of anomalies in a standard model, it's only anomaly-free when you sum over the entire generation. Right, you have to include the lepton doublet, quark doublet, the SU2 singlets, right? And you have no need for an additional neutrino. Right? This kind of shows you that as you didn't need to add any extra matter to satisfy these constraints.
This is where we came in. So when I first asked about the anomaly cancellation,
this is different because, I mean, maybe the direction is kind of different. I don't think this doesn't rely on any. Here, I think the key structure you got from this was the fact that this quark doublet can't have a non-zero charge. Right? That was, I think, a key assumption. Otherwise, I think if you want to do anomaly stuff, you have to assume something has charge or some structure of the matter. That's why I kind of view that as more of a consistency type thing, although maybe I'm not understanding the specific one you were mentioning, the Lorentz U1 anomaly. But yeah, here I kind of take it as, you know, if I want to build an anomaly-free standard model-like theory, the fact that as soon as I have something which I want to be non-singlet under some gauge group, it has a charge. The relation between these charges, like I said, is consistent with the standard model charges, but there's no, you have to fix one charge in order to get the rest. Once I fix one of the charges, all the other charges come out, and they're all equal to the standard model charge, of course. That's not surprising. But yeah, I don't know how strong you want to take this type of argument, but I think this kind of fact in these models, that you can't have a zero charge for a non-singlet under the non-abelian part, I think that's kind of, I don't know, to me that's interesting. You have this much structure in this non-linearly realized symmetry in a CPK model. Of course, mathematically, these are probably some trivial facts. Charge quantization is definitely a trivial fact in CPK models from considering vector bundles and stuff, but in the physics context, I don't think it's so trivial. Yeah, so I mean, this kind of goes to those questions, right? There's some interesting relation between anomalies, charge quantization, the matter content in the standard model, right? It all, when you just learn the standard model, it looks kind of like, oh, it works out. Like it's anomaly free, you know, the charges sum to zero, all this stuff. And we're getting some of that structure out of these models, which I think is more than the standard, you know, structure you find in just thinking about the standard model.
The structure is, the statement is that given that I have things that are doublets and I presumably triplets under SC3, but I just say hypercharge assignments are just numbers, I don't know what the hell they are, then use all the anomaly conditions in the standard model and lines of variance, and you're saying that up to normal scaling factor, I know what all the hypercharges are. So that's the statement.
In this case, yeah.
Yeah, that was my own thing. That's the standard rents an anomaly argument. If you're only floating the hypercharges, then anomalies nail up the normalization.
But can you add, you know, then some additional SU2, well, okay, now you can't add as a chiral thing, but.
If you broke your vector-like matter assumption, your vector-like matter wouldn't necessarily have perfects, but also quantized.
Yeah, all the charges are quantized here. If I don't have vector-like matter, this is just satisfied by adding, like, one quark doublet, another quark doublet. They have vector matter, there's no anomalies, everything's fine, right? So the minimal thing I can do with vector-like matter is just a single set of vector matter.
Yeah, but
right?
The point about vector-like matter and the normal anomaly isolation condition is that you don't have to have it in the same charge compensation.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, here it doesn't matter what if it's vector-like or singular, what it, no matter what, its charge is quantized, that's right. Yeah, so I guess to that other argument, if you didn't have this, if you just thought about what matter I could write down, I could write vector-like matter, which doesn't have any anomaly constraints then.
So I can cross off your no vector-like matter.
Yeah, well, then I don't get this, though. I don't get the standard model generation thing. Yeah. Yeah, the charge quantization is independent of this argument. This is just kind of the, you know, this observation of the connection between, right? I mean, it's just, I mean, even forget the fact that it can't be zero, just the fact that this enters, right, this n-ality, the representation under the SUN of CPK, that I think is unexpected and kind of interesting. So you can do some interesting other pheno stuff too, is you can, in this model, the Higgs, the Nyman-Goldstone boson has the right quantum numbers to be the Higgs, assuming you fix the hypercharge. So there might be some way to relate to that, to these conformal or scale invariant Higgs models at Planck scale, for instance. Although that's not as simple as just that statement, of course, but you might see some connection there. You know, or in CP3, the Nyman-Goldstone boson has quantum numbers like a quark, not the SU2 numbers, but the hypercharge and the color quantum numbers like a squark. So interesting. So there's a lot of model building phenomenology you can do with this kind of stuff with the Nyman-Goldstone bosons. But one of the next logical steps is, can you take this to be the standard model? Can the standard model be the linearly realized subgroup of non-linearly realized symmetry? The answer is yes. We also have that we're working on finishing the details on. You can do that also as this kind of thing. That's quite a bit more complicated, but similar in spirit, I'd say, to embedding the CP1. I don't know offhand if.
Here, the charge quantum expansion condition seems similar to what you get from just embedding the thing.
Yeah, I don't know about this last point, though, if you're embedding more than the U1. So if you're embedding weak times U1 in a gut thing, do you have this relation between the charges like that? That, I think, I should say, I think that. Yeah, I'm not sure if that, but you obviously get a relation because you have these multiplets, right? The way the matter multiplets. So there is some relation there, but it's, yeah, so it's that's also something we should probably compare more carefully to. Maybe to some of these funny gut models where you're just putting some subgroup of the standard model into a gut. But yeah, so there you get the gut kind of relations, the fact that, you know, we usually think of it the other way. The fact the standard model fits together as a 5 and 10, or, you know, a 10 of SO10 or whatever, a 24 of SO10. Right, these kind of things, you're like, oh, it's just amazing that it just fits together. Or from the top down, you're saying, okay, let me take an SU5 and I get the matter of the standard model. So, you know, that structure here is replaced instead by this charge kind of structure, which is different, I think.
It seems like the sort of most non-trivial thing that you're getting is different from what you get from
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say you can.
It's also true in the, you know, when you gauge a non-nullifying section that you want, or any, with the sort of non-nullifying gauge equation.
Yeah, so I think those were the questions you got asked about having the U1 as part of just some, not, I don't know if you call it a gut, but, you know, embedding the U1 in some other gut type thing, but not the rest of it. Does that follow in a similar way? You know, how are those models just this, a different limit of the same thing? I think is a fair thing. Anyway, I guess I'll end here. I could talk more about other, you know, stuff, but I kind of mentioned basically, I think, all the key points. So thank you for listening. Yeah, so I went over time, or
it's not your fault.
No, it's good. I think, I mean, the questions you guys asked are not, you're not the only, when I've given parts of this talk elsewhere, you're not the only ones asking these types of questions. So some of it needs to be clarified a little. I think some of it's maybe more interesting when you go beyond CP1, because then you see more structure, so it looks less like something familiar, but still thinking about these other types of gut stuff. It's just, I mean, I guess maybe we're a little biased coming from more of like a pheno background about guts, where, you know, you don't do guts for charge quantization. Charge quantization was kind of like the best free thing you ever got, right? I mean, and it's the most model independent prediction, I would say. Although it's relatively model independent, say you have things like proton decay, double triplet splitting, just that's the structure of a gut. But charge quantization is maybe like the best thing to come out of it. That's completely model independent, just by definition of a gut. So really the question was, could we do that without a gut? Really our question was, could you do that without a monopole? That was the way we originally approached it. But in the CP2 also, you don't have any monopole solutions. In both of these, you have strings, which scale is set by this V or M. So that's very high for all the examples we're thinking of, really. But there's no monopoles in this one either. So that's, I think, interesting. But
let's think.